Welcome to the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm Yannis Papadakis, business development manager at CREXI and today's host. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics and conversations with featured experts to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news in commercial real estate. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome and thank you all for joining us for this episode of the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm your host, Yannis Papadakis, business development manager at CREXI. And today we are thrilled to be sitting down with David Skinner. Now, before we dive in, a little bit about our guest. David is a native New Englander who grew up in Hudson, New Hampshire. He graduated from Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota, graduating with a degree in biblical and theological studies. He began his sales career by selling recycled pallets, where he learned how to sell scraps of wood to large companies. After 3 years of walking into warehouses looking for the warehouse manager, David moved across the country to begin selling industrial real estate in the Boston market. Now he walks into warehouses looking for the owner of the company. About 5 years after working as a real estate advisor, David felt the call to begin Prescott Advisory, a firm that specializes in industrial sales and leasing in the greater Boston market. David's sales and leasing volume at the time he left to begin Prescott Advisory was north of $300 million as he represented companies as small as the local manufacturer and working with the local giant, Amazon.com. David founded the CRE Coach in 2019 when he saw the need to democratize the commercial real estate business by making the business easy, clear, transparent, and informative by creating videos on topics ranging from sales, leasing, management, and negotiation. David, welcome to the podcast.
Nice to meet you guys. Thank you for having me on here.
Absolutely. Now, I know we covered a little bit about your background, but I'd like to briefly learn more about your career path and some of the lessons that were learned along the way. How did you get your start in commercial real estate?
I thought I was going to go down the track of the biblical studies track. Thought I was going to go to a seminary, thought I was going to be a pastor, and then just the kind of doors open, doors close. And I ended up doing the pallet thing, as you mentioned, and I learned sales. And when you learn how to sell a pallet, you kind of can learn how to sell any, I realized you could sell anything, but there's only so much money you can make selling pallets. No disrespect to pallets, but it's limited. And this was right around the Trump's first run, seemed to be very successful in the real estate business. I didn't know what that even meant. I didn't know what the difference between a developer and a real estate agent. And I thought, wow, seems like this guy's making a lot of money. So I knew that I wanted to make a bet on myself, and rather than just waiting for like a salary with a limited bonus opportunity. And so I thought, so that's when my mind started going. And then I got a Facebook message from a guy who was from back home in New Hampshire. He didn't even know I had moved away. And he said, hey, are you interested in real estate? And I thought, I'm totally interested. And then I had a phone call with the guys that ran the company that I just recently left from. And it worked. It was just right place, right time. Moved to Boston. I'd never lived in the city, but then I moved to Boston and then started back in 2017. And here we are.
So, okay, a couple of questions there. The theological background is very interesting. Just curious, do you have a seminary in the family? Was it something that was just like an early calling, or is it something that is kind of a familial calling?
Yeah, I mean, I would say actually, I'd probably say neither. But I mean, my faith's important to me. I've always been part of really involved in the churches that I've been a part of throughout my life. And I think that I think that work is really important. And I love the Bible. I love studying the Bible. I love preaching, all that. And it just seemed like that was I heard a quote from a pastor, author, and he said, if you could do anything other than being a pastor, you should do it. Which, funny enough, I loved it. I loved what I was doing, but I thought, honestly, I love turning $1 into $2. And what I didn't want to do was be distracted from it's a calling and it's a life's work. Cause you're right. You're there for whoever you're serving. And I thought, you know what? I think I want to try this. And then that has turned into this. And that was 10 years ago or so.
Wow. Yeah. And I was going to ask, what drew you to industrial, but it seemed like you had already had a lot of familiarity with the world of industrial via, the pallet thing that you were doing. You were taking a look at industrial buildings and talking to those owners, I'm sure, a lot beforehand. Let's talk about some of your mentors. How did they shape your career path kind of when you started transitioning into commercial real estate?
So, yeah, to touch on the question that we sort of skipped, I didn't even know what being a real estate agent even was. I didn't know that that's not what Trump did. I thought, oh, wow, this is a very different thing. But, he made a lot of money. Real estate agents can make a lot of money. And these are the guys that reached out to me just so happened to be in the warehouse business. That was part of the reason why I thought it was actually a really good fit, because I thought, oh, wow, I know how to go cold call warehouse guys. And it's a lot of the same type of person. So it just felt like a really natural fit. I think they saw it. I saw it. So that's how I got into industrial. But as far as mentors, so these guys that I worked for was a company called the Stubblebine Company. They're a really strong company out in Boston. And they was a family business, been around for 30 years. They're the guys that run the company now. Their dad had passed away early on. And so they were kind of forced to pick themselves up by their bootstraps. And so from the time they were in their early 20s, they were just absolute grinders. And they would make more calls than anyone I'd ever seen. I'd never seen people work as hard as these guys. And I was just blown away. And so I learned, I would say just from a mentor standpoint, I saw these guys show what it means to eat, drink, and sleep. They eat, drink, and sleep real estate. And they're always thinking how they hear one piece of information from one client and they think, oh, I should go call this guy and turn this into this into this. And so I just saw how that deal-making perspective, but I joke around with them because I'm like, yeah, I was raised by a pack of wolves. It is, you do eat what you kill. And it was an intense environment, but it was really good because it showed me how to work hard and put deals together.
What were some of the early lessons that you learned during that formidable period?
There's always a question, I think, and I still even have it now. I think anyone, you were a broker, so I know, you know what it's like when you're on trying to figure out the best way to get through to a prospect when you're thinking about, oh, how should I be spending my day? Oh, this guy told me to follow up in a couple weeks. It feels like it's been a little soon. One of the best rules of thumb that I ever learned was if you're questioning whether or not you should make a call, make the call. Always make the call. And it's just amazing how much business that I've been a part of, that I have been able to participate in, relationships that I've had, just because I didn't rest on my laurels. That was one of the things I learned from these guys was if you're ever wondering if you should make a phone call, then that means you're probably scared and there's probably a good reason you're scared. So you should go make the freaking call. And that, even this morning, a couple times this morning, and I called the guy a little bit before he told me to call him back. And he said, hey, I'm really glad you called. It's just amazing how powerful that is. Because if you're not going to call them, someone else is going to call them. And the other one is, I think it's harder for younger guys to know what to spend time on. And I look at the brokers, men, women, all the above, who are the most successful. You listen to the way they talk about what they are working on, and their instincts are just so sharp to know this is a good use of time, this is not a good use of time. And so not even now, whenever I talk to someone, whenever I talk to anyone, but particularly guys who've been around for a long time and are doing, millions of dollars a year in revenue, I'm always asking, what are your top three things you're working on? I always ask that question because if there's not an immediate reason, if there's not an immediate deal to be done, they're looking at the scope of the relationship and saying, you know what, this kind of relationship is not that valuable. This kind of relationship is valuable. And that has helped me learn the difference, because when you, if you're only getting paid on commissions, then when a deal gets done, then that means that at the only, your product is your time. You're selling yourself, and the way that you most effectively utilize your time is the way that you are going to or not going to make money. So sometimes the best way to use time is to give free work to the right people, knowing that it's going to pay itself back. And I've just seen that many, many time and time again. So yeah, always making the call if you're thinking about it, and always focusing on how can I get my deal instincts, my client instincts, my prospecting instincts a little bit better.
Right. Do you have any favorite mistakes or moments that course corrected you onto your current path that at the time you didn't recognize as opportunities?
I mean, there's, in the brokerage world, there, I mean, I'm sure it sounds bad that I can't think of a ton. I mean, one is the value of who you bring to the table. So I had done a ton of work for, I mean, probably everyone in the industrial business knows Ferguson Plumbing. They sell plumbing supplies. They're nationally represented. And I didn't know that. This was early on. This was probably 6 months in. I got to know the local manager, and I'll say that I did not represent them. I was not the national representative. Got to know the local manager. He said, oh yeah, these guys really aren't performing. I'll make sure you're taken care of when, if we ever end up doing a deal. Turns out he actually didn't have any authority to say that. And great experience with the company. It wasn't any, it had nothing to do with them being a certain company. But when they have a relationship, that relationship has to get honored. What that taught me though, taking a step back and thinking, okay, the value of brokerage is your client relationships. So that forced me to say, I want to make sure that I'm working with the best people and I actually can represent them, which really focused my prospecting efforts on, I want to prospect for the right companies. I want to make sure that I have the kind of relationship where they see the value in me and they are putting me forth as their representative and not just saying, hey, we'll take care of you, but hey, you're actually our guy. We're willing to sign you up. We're willing to hire you, which really changed the way that I thought about the business and relationships in general.
So let's move on to our topic for the day, covering your unique approach to client education in the commercial real estate space. What is the CRE coach and what made you decide to focus on education as part of your business?
I was trying to figure out, how do you keep up with people in between deals? So most clients only do deals every few years, every 3 to 5 years, call it. And maybe it's less frequently even than that. So the question is, how do you stay top of mind? My thought was, oh, well, videos were just becoming popular, 2017, 2018. That was becoming a thing where it was easy to get lower cost video equipment for higher quality product. And I didn't see anyone doing it. It, you know, now a lot of people are doing it, but That's initially how it started. And it was funny, some of the pushback I got was from the older guys who had been around the business for a while. They were saying, well, you don't want to tell all your secrets. And that, it's funny that that was initially the feedback. Young people don't say that. I've never heard anyone, I'm not even going to define who's young and who's old, but I would say the people that grew up with cell phones and grew up watching YouTube videos never would think to say that sort of a comment, because they just look on YouTube. Oh, I mean, any of us, we can just search on YouTube how to do whatever and someone's going to explain it to you. So then the question is, well, why don't you just be the guy that has all the answers? Whether or not you're an idiot or not, I started doing this. I mean, I'd been in the business for like 2 years and I had a couple people call me out, like, who do you think you are? It's like, well, whatever. But I think that's the answer. It's just become the guy that has all the answers.
Now, transparency is a big part of your philosophy. How does that inform your work with clients and why is it so valuable to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it has to do with that whole philosophy of hoarding information.
Right.
You could say, I'm a basketball guy. Michael Jordan was hands down the guy. You guys are from LA, so sorry about that. It's just sad. But he was so clearly the most dominant and feared. Now, if he sat down and taught you a course on everything that he knew, that has nothing, would have zero bearing on whether or there are some things maybe that, you know, some of his competitors would pick up that could make them more effective. But to actually be the best, that comes down to day in, day out, planning the work, working the plan relentlessly until you totally destroy your competition. And most people are looking for answers. They're not looking for action. And that's where I don't really care. I'm happy to tell anyone anything. I'm happy to share lessons. There's maybe a couple things that I wouldn't say. But when push comes to shove, I don't even think it matters. Like if you have my proposal templates, it doesn't really matter unless you're actually, you have the discipline to go out every single day and perform. And at the end of the day, people see that transparency and they recognize the honesty and the fact you're not trying to pull a fast one. And you gain so much more credibility than you lose in, I don't know, trying to hoard information.
Right. I think clients, for the most part, they absolutely notice and respect when you are able to present, you know, information that, you know, perhaps isn't the best for them to hear, but they know you're being honest with them and they can use that information in a way that's going to benefit them down the road, you know, as opposed to just, you know, pricing your proposal higher than where, you know, everybody else is going to be, right? It's here and here's why, and here's the data to back it up. What are some of the most common questions you get from brokers and investors about your expertise? Anything surprising?
Which expertise?
In terms of what?
What world are you talking about?
The expertise as the CRE coach, right? Anything that comes from left field or things that kind of surprise you that you hear people asking, you know, curveballs that you're thrown pretty frequently.
So when most of the content that I've made is not rocket science, and most people, they either know or it feels like common sense. But what it does do is it creates some trust where I'll have got whenever I post a video or send someone a video, it will lead to further questions. It won't necessarily say, oh, wow, you've illuminated this concept that I had no idea how to understand. That's not what I hear. But mostly what it does is it opens the doors to say, hey, I'm dealing with this. What do you think? I see that you're really active. You're really putting thought into what you're doing. How do you deal with this situation? I have to, whatever, fill in the blank with whatever that is. And, you know, it's, you know, whether it's real estate related or not, I'm kind of banking on the fact, I mean, I've been around for 6 years. So in the vast scheme of things, not long at all. I'm banking on the fact that these are 20-year relationships that are going to begin with them seeing this sort of thing. And then down the road, it'll be, oh, I'm going to sell my building for whatever. Or I need to buy something, or I need to go sign a lease, whatever. That's kind of what I'm banking on, just because the nature of the business is so trust and relationship driven.
There's also something to be said too, if you're creating content, you're putting videos out. Every time you do that, that video is always, it's like planting a flag. It's you that's out there on the internet somewhere that's talking, and it's omnipresent, right? You don't actually have to be there to talk to somebody anymore, right? Anybody that's interested in that topic can hear directly from you at any time, you know, whether or not you're actually there to do it. So it's kind of brilliant to, you know, be putting out this content information in a way that really gives you, kind of multiplies your ability to educate and connect with people. Now, part of CRE coach, I know I wanted to go over this with you, are your four principles. Can you go over your four principles and how do you apply these to your own business?
I think it's a way of doing business. So easy, clear, transparent, and informative. Where that came from is there's a lot of components, especially for someone. So on the easy part of it, there are so many components to doing a deal that it can feel like, what's the next? It just oftentimes someone who's not gone through it or not gone through it often is going to ask, what's the next step? If you're foreign to the process, it feels like, okay, it feels confusing. When do we submit the letter of intent? When do we wait for them? Do we wait for them to give us something first? What's the best way to negotiate the purchase and sale? Should you have an attorney do it? Should the broker be involved? And it's not actually complicated stuff, but if you don't have a clear, so that's, there's some bleed over from clear, easy. They're all kind of similar things, but I think making something really easy to understand and trying to remove the mystery is just really important. And ultimately at the end of the day, people are going to see you as an advisor and someone who's worth keeping around. If you do that part, that's part of the clarity piece too, is when there's a lot of, so making it easy is saying more, it's more so demonstrating that it's easy. And the way that you demonstrate something is easy by you mastering the process, which means that you've got to figure it out yourself. With regard to clarity, there are so many little extraneous details that as a broker, you can get bogged down into. The trouble with that is, well, there's a lot of trouble with that. Your job, you get paid. People call you because they want to know, what's the fluff? What do I really need to know? Right. And so to clarify, to say, hey, I know we just talked about 100 different things. Here's the one thing that you need to think about right now. That becomes helpful. Or if you say, you know what, we've talked about 6 options. You really need to think about, do you want to do this or do you want to do that? And turning things from either a 1-point summary or a 2-point question has really helped me thinking about, okay, when it feels confusing, are there 1 or 2 options here? If you feel like there are more than 2 options, it becomes unclear. And your direction, the way that you give direction, it just becomes muddied. And then people are like, well, I don't know what to do. And then when someone feels like they're frozen, that's when deals stall and then ultimately die. So keeping things easy and clear. And then, well, the transparency is more so from a personal way of operating. I'm going to be totally transparent. I want my clients knowing what I'm getting paid. I want my clients knowing if something is above market, not above market. And, I want them to know I have nothing to hide. There are no secrets in the business. If you're afraid of telling your client what you're making, then you're making too much, or you don't understand the, or you're not making too much. Take that back. You are misrepresenting what the market is willing to pay. So I hear that a lot. I hear a lot of brokers will say, well, I don't really know if I want my client knowing what I'm making, because then they might say, oh, you're making more than me. Well, if you're asking for market compensation, for taking that as an example, then that means that anyone else is going to ask the same thing. And if you're ashamed of it, then you should either go out and educate yourself, or you shouldn't be trying to screw anybody. So that's why that knowing, operating from the standpoint that anything, that any information that's out there, I assume everyone will know the details of a deal. If you're trying to pull a fast one to make another buck, assume that someone's going to find out. So what are you going to do when someone finds out? Are you okay with being on, you know, the cover of the Boston Business Journal with all the details of the last deal you just did? If the answer is yes, then go for it. And oh, my dad has an awesome quote, and I'm probably going to butcher it, but it's, people of integrity expect to be believed, and when they aren't, they let time prove them right. I didn't butcher it. That's actually the quote. And so I just live my life that way. And so if someone says, oh, you're a shyster, you're trying to take advantage of me, okay, I'm not. And I'm not, so I don't lose sleep, because I'm fully transparent in every aspect of business. And then the last, what was the last one? I had them all written down in my brain. Oh, being informative. So with regard specifically to content, so with the CRE coach, it's content driven. I mean, it's all content. That's the whole point of it. I don't want to just summarize like, oh, this is what a lease means. Like, I know what a lease is. Be helpful. And so when it comes to creating content, it's really easy to just create filler. Oh, I want to get my blog post out this week. I want to get this video done. I actually want to help people. And so that means all of these things take work. Making things easy, making them clear, being transparent, staying informative. That means that you are constantly having to consume stuff. You're constantly having to digest. You're constantly having to distill and make and actually think about, how is what I know helping the next person? And if you're doing all of those things, people will love you. They'll love talking to you. They'll say, wow, this guy's got a lot to offer.
Now, this kind of segues really well into my next question, which is, you know, why do you think education is so vital in commercial real estate? But especially as the market shifts into the next cycle phase, I think anybody that's been paying attention right now, you know, anybody that had a crystal ball, you know, doesn't these days. And I don't think anybody ever did, but the market is becoming, I would say, less predictable now. Why is this education so vital in the face of a market where, you know, people are putting their finger in the air and getting different answers as to which way the wind is blowing?
When you say next cycle phase, what does that mean?
You know, we've seen a phase of, you know, cap rate compression happening, you know, over the last, you know, minus the last 2 years, over the last 5 years, and that stopped happening. We're watching interest rates go up, you know, as the market shifts in terms of, you know, sellers are no longer commanding the market as much as buyers are. Buyers have taken some more power. You know, how does this cycle, this phase of the commercial real estate cycle, how does your education play into, you know, what we're seeing happening now?
I think you got to know your stuff. So I'm speaking of brokers. You got to know your stuff. You have to know what's actually going on. Actually, what's the data? What is the actual data of what's happening? What deals are or are not happening? Because a lot of people can talk about, oh, wow, this bank shut their doors. Oh, I'm sure cap rates are going up for the, you know, because the interest rates are going up. You need, brokers are valuable because they have real data of, oh yeah, this building was under contract and then it's not anymore. Or yeah, these guys still closed in spite of all the market conditions. And knowing that gives people a real perspective on what transactions are actually going on. So that's where being and staying educated, yes, from a standpoint of, I mean, a lot of the CRE coaches, more general, how to do business, how to do the commercial real estate business. But I think in times like this, actually just knowing your stuff and recognizing, hey, we as brokers need to just know what's happening. So you can't stop learning. You can never stop learning. And I never think that, no matter how young or old or in or out of touch someone is, I'm always coming into whatever conversation I'm having thinking, how can I learn from this person? What's one thing I can get? If not more than one thing I can learn from whoever I'm speaking with.
It sounds like you put a pretty high value on the ability to network within the market and talk to the boots on the ground brokers and understand what's happening from their perspective. You know, it's one thing to, you know, being, you know, tapped into, you know, news and, you know, media sources and, you know, different websites that you're checking for information, but you really can't replace the, you know, boots on the ground, you know, market intel that the brokers that are in there, you know, in the trenches, you know, making those deals or not making those deals, are actually getting. It seems to, you know, really kind of inform, you know, how you approach, you know, market knowledge.
I think, unfortunately, I agree with everything you just said. I think, unfortunately, the brokerage world is incentivized against each other.
Right.
From a financial standpoint, typically, in commercial. In residential, it's funny, when you deal with a residential agent, a lot of times you can tell they're used to co-broking. And I don't know if it's market to market, but I mean, around in Boston, there's not a lot of co-broking, even amongst friends. And especially since I've started, it's funny because I've become, I think, even more so the way that I am now since I started Prescott Advisory, because I've realized that you're only as good as what you know. And a lot of the stuff that we need to know is the data that we need, the facts, the deals, the numbers that we actually need to know we're not going to find it by reading the Wall Street Journal. It's, oh yeah, I know that guy down the street just did this deal or didn't do this deal. And if I don't know, chances are some broker out there knows. So I've really reprioritized a lot of my time and just, hey, let's get lunch. Let's get a coffee before work. Let me come to your office if you don't mind. And I've just been blown away by how much I've learned. Like, man, I didn't really do that for 5 years. I didn't do it. Now I'm just blowing my mind. I think your point is totally right. You need to have relationships with people like that. And the thing is, if your deal velocity goes up, you'll make more money, even if you're sharing fees. So it just, I don't understand the whole don't co-broke thing. It just feels really short-sighted and foolish.
It seems it's I 100% agree. I found when I was wearing the broker hat, the more people I brought in on deals, the more deals I was brought in on. And it was a very, very clear relationship between the two. It wasn't until I started bringing people in on deals that people started bringing me in on deals. Funny how that works, but it does work. Now, shifting gears a little bit, you specialize in the industrial sector as a broker and entrepreneur. What is the current state of the industrial market in your region of focus, New England, Boston area?
Still strong. There's still just a lot of business. The Boston is kind of controlled, not controlled by, but it's the activity in the market is driven by the colleges, MIT, Harvard, Tufts Medical, and then the hospitals, huge hospital networks that are all kind of around, especially particularly Boston. So the business is within 50 miles of downtown are still going strong. I mean, you've got vacant properties that are in vacant industrial buildings that are in these odd areas that are maybe, you know, 7 miles from a highway, but that'll happen anywhere. And, you know, in any kind of slowdown economically, you'll have the buildings that are furthest from the highway going first. So we're seeing a little bit of that, but it's still strong.
Are you seeing the demand for industrial is typically being filled by people with industrial uses, or are you seeing a lot of adaptive reuse kind of coming in to try to reshape, you know, what used to be industrial into something different?
It had been that. It had been that for a few years. A lot of my, I mean, I've only really known a good cycle. So, I mean, for a few years, that's what it's been turning into, especially around Cambridge, specific Cambridge, Somerville, being these right where MIT and Harvard are, right in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There's these huge biotech centers, huge life science. And so a lot of these industrial zoned areas are, had gotten either rezoned or just permitted for lab space or GMP, CGMP manufacturing. And I mean, that's all just slowed way back because slowed way down because it's so much more expensive to build anything. And those are expensive build outs. So now it's just select sites. And so there's, I think there had been there, it was a torrid pace for probably 4 years. And now 2018, it just started going bananas. And now it's, I think, tapered off to where rents are coming back to normal or a little bit more.
So that kind of segues into my next question. Are you seeing any trends in industrial pricing, both on the sale and on the leasing side? And then to add to that, what opportunities are you seeing in this current climate?
Well, the speculative sellers are gone. So the guys that thought, oh, my building's worth 100 a foot, I'm going to get 150. They're just gone. They're keeping the building. Anyone who doesn't need to sell is not selling. And there are still deals happening. They're just a lot fewer and further between. There's a lot of speculation on all these adjustable rate mortgages. I don't know how real that is. We'll find out in the next 5 years, I guess. But we're not really, I mean, I don't see sale prices going down. I'm just not seeing them go out of control, but I'm not seeing them go down.
What about buyer sentiment? Seems like sellers, if they don't have to sell, aren't selling. Is the buyer level maintaining? Are we seeing, you know, more or less demand currently right now?
Yeah, I've actually, shout out to the New England Real Estate Journal. So they gave me an opportunity to start writing articles within probably a year when I started. I don't think I should have been writing articles then, but they gave me an opportunity. So now I write about a lot of this stuff there. And one of the topics that comes up a lot is when, you know, this whole pricing thing, when is it going to adjust? Who's interested? What are buyers saying? Most at this point, buyers are waiting for the bottom to fall out. And I've got I've listed a 75,000 foot investment deal, and it's kind of a secondary market, but everyone, all the buyers, they're all saying, if it's not a 10 cap, I'm not interested. And these are people that I've gone to that have said that I've seen buy five caps in the last 3 years. And for similar kinds of product, five, six caps, and now they're saying, yeah, it's just not worth anything less than a 10. So I think they're waiting for the bottom to fall out, or it's got to be a great deal. So right. Eventually that means that things are going to change eventually, but it's just not happening right now because the sellers are just saying, well, I'm not selling for a 10 cap yet.
I can echo that sentiment. It does seem like a lot of buyers that, you know, have, you know, a lot of dry powder right now are still kind of on the sideline waiting for, you know, what I'm hearing is more blood in the water, so to speak. Especially, well, I actually have seen a caveat to that. On the auction platform, we are seeing, I would say, more buyer engagement than we have traditionally, have historically. And I think it's—
Is that because auctions have a little bit of a reputation, if you will, of being kind of a lower price, lower, like higher value?
I think that's part of it. I think you're right there. I think that's part of it. I think what buyers are attracted to in auctions today are, okay, if I think— why would I buy a building today if I think I could get it for cheaper in 6 months? I think why buyers are attracted to auctions today are, maybe I can get 6 month pricing today as opposed to waiting 6 months for it. You know, the problem with that is, you know, what if there are seven or eight other people that are trying to do the same thing? But I think that that is, has kind of been echoed with, you know, a lot of sellers and principals that come to the auction platform and say, we're having a hard time getting buyers' attention right now. We feel like we're priced appropriately, you know, data shows that we are, but we're having a hard time getting buyers' attention. You know, related to that, what are your thoughts on industrial supply limitations driving up valuations, right? Because there is only so much, and, you know, Boston being such an infill market, right? If sellers aren't selling it, then it really does, you know, drive up demand for those that are still trying to acquire properties like that. You know, when does rent get too high for current prospective tenants? I know you mentioned that they are cooling off a little bit.
Well, sale prices are. Yeah, rents are cooling a little bit. But there's really, all that's changed is the mark-to-market buyers, investors are not in anymore because, or they're at least not being, they've become like any other value add kind of player.
Right.
And that has meant that sale prices are not continuing to go up and up and up and up and up, but rents have kind of stayed the same. So the buyer pool has changed. The tenant pool hasn't changed that much, at least not yet. What has happened is users can now compete because they're seeing, oh, wow, this building that's been worth $50 my whole life, I'm willing to pay 70. I'm not willing to pay 130. And now it's like, well, maybe they're, whereas the speculative investors are saying, well, yeah, I'm kind of back down to that 50 number. A user's saying, yeah, I'll pay 70. I could probably get up to 80. And so now users are back in the game.
Now, what should current owners look out for in terms of industrial tenants? You know, what makes for a high value tenant in today's market?
Cash and credit. They have money that they're willing to put into a facility, and they have a strong balance sheet, which are kind of, I guess, two sides of the same coin. But it's one right now, I think, I don't know what you're seeing around the world with the other people you talk to, but it seems like the values on a tenant that's not likely going to go out of business.
Right.
So for the ones, the companies that have strong balance sheets and are willing to invest in the property, shows that they've got real skin in the game. Those are the ones that have, that are going to, there's a deal right now that I'm a part of where there's a building just came on the market for a huge, huge, huge price, massive price per square foot, amazing location. And we have a tenant, but the building's a disaster. It's like a nightmare disaster, needs a ton of money. You know, needs a ton of money. So we have a tenant that's basically saying, I'm going to pay kind of a dirt rent and I'm going to put a lot into the building. The seller, the owner saying, I would just rather keep it, have them improve the building. I'm fine with the short money on the lease and I would rather not sell it, which is just says a lot to me about the value of, you know, that they, it sounds like they were scared that they couldn't find another tenant. And now that they've got someone that is in there investing in the building, it just changes the way you think about the value, changes the way you, as a broker, it changes the way you think about the value of tenants. And it means you're probably prospecting for different kinds of tenants.
Right. All right. Moving on to our next topic, you know, given your specialized background and expertise, I'm sure our listeners are curious about your answers to some rapid fire questions, words of advice that we've got for you. Are you ready for a couple?
Go for it.
All right. If you were given $10 million today and had to invest it immediately, what would be your go-to asset type and location and why?
Proximity to highway is huge. That's the first thing. Proximity to highway and, well, first would be proximity to a major market on the highway. Construction costs have gotten so crazy that a lot of land deals have fallen out of contract. And for any kind of seller that needs to sell now, a piece of land in a well-located area, that might not be a bad place to just park some money. And I think over time, if you get it at the right basis, there is, the developers that made the most money over the last few years were the ones that had the best located piece of land that they could either build or flip. And there's a lot of people that made a lot of money by just owning the right piece of land in the right area.
Nice. All right. Number two, favorite tool or software you use on the job? This is not a trick question.
Crexy is obviously the answer.
Awesome. Always glad to hear that one. And then what is the most common?
Secondarily is the iPad.
iPad. Okay.
I don't think the iPad would compete with you. Nice. So having an iPad that's connected to internet, that the Apple Maps feature is really good, really great. You should write this down. Even if you have an iPhone, it's even the same. They have the same thing. So there's a 3D option on the satellite view. There's a 3D option and you can zoom in and see stunning specific data you can see these photos. I mean, I don't know what satellite they use, but you can get in at diagonal or at angles. So when you're at a meeting with a prospect or client, you can say, hey, let's look at this neighborhood, hit the 3D button. And it looks like you're zoomed in. It's incredible. And it's changed the way I do meetings now.
Nice. And finally, what is the most common misconception about your job or industry?
You know what? I saw this question and I'd love to ask you that because you probably know more than I do.
Let's see. Biggest misconception about our industry. I would say a pretty big misconception about our industry is I think people outside of the industry don't realize how specialized people within the industry are. If you do industrial in the Northeast, then you should be able to prepare a valuation for me for my restaurant in Arizona, because commercial is commercial. And I don't think people outside of the industry really understand how, even if you do industrial and you're in two different locations, the markets themselves, the clients, the tenants can vary wildly, sometimes within a few blocks of one another, depending on what market you're in. So I think that kind of appreciating the specialization that's out there is sometimes missed on people outside of the industry, which is why I always recommend, if you're trying to start a business or, trying to become an investor in, a specific market, talk to the brokers that are active in that market that are selling and listing those deals and ask them questions. Even if you've got a cousin that's got his broker's license, if he's not active in that market in those types of deals, it's going to be hard for you to really derive anything of real value just because they, happen to be licensed. So that's what I would say.
That's really funny. I had someone today ask me, oh, so do you now, you're doing a lot in Boston. Do you only do commercial? I'm like, what? How can, it's like, yes, I only do commercial. But as a funny kind of a story, which I definitely will not say the name of who I'm talking about, but I'm working on being a local agent for a national firm who has a national relationship. They're out of state. Their local guy is the local agent working on the project is that they have the particular person that they have that I'm talking about that's working on the assignment is it's a highly, highly specialized assignment in a highly specialized area, which just so happens to be my area and my specialty. So when I found out that they were working with a guy in the local office, that's like a multifamily person in a different submarket, I was just like, this was one of my phone calls today. I was just giddy because I cannot wait to get the call and say, hey, we haven't found anything yet, because it's really hard when you're looking for certain kinds of things. So I think the takeaway for a broker is, based on what you just said, is have a specialty, like, and really, really, really focus on that specialty, because then you can compete with anybody. National firm, not national firm, doesn't matter.
Absolutely. And I just want to say, you know, thank you for joining us and sharing your insights today. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. I know you're very busy, and we appreciate you spending the time to sit down with us.
Nice to meet you guys. It's a pleasure and an honor.
David, where can people find you online if they want to get in touch? Email, social media, give them the website.
Yeah, the CREcoach.com is where the videos lie. Haven't updated in a bit, because as I've been building the brokerage company, that kind of took a little bit of a back seat, but that's going to hopefully this year take off. My email is david@prescottadvisory, spelled like it sounds. And I would love to hear. And if anyone has questions or just wants to run something past me, I'd love to be a listening ear like the many people who were for me when I was getting started. So thank you guys for asking me to be on the show. This has been really, really enjoyable.
Absolutely. Our pleasure. Thank you, David.
Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexi.com/podcast. That's go.crexi.com/podcast. And sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexi podcast on your favorite podcast app, or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/Crexi for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, we'll see you next time.